This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhib. Coming up on Africa News Tonight,
South Africa's High Court ruled Wednesday that the government cannot withdraw from the International Criminal Court without parliamentary approval.
That's VOA's Anita Powell reporting. Details coming up.
Also, according to Amnesty International, repression and xenophobia are just some of the threats to human rights in Africa. And the UN calls on the South African government to speed up paperwork so emergency aid can be delivered to famine areas in Unity State.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story, growing authoritarianism, conflict, increased crackdowns on free protests, political tensions and repression, and xenophobia are just some of the threats to human rights in Africa, said Amnesty International today during a rollout of its annual report. From Nairobi, VOA's Jill Craig has more.
During the Nairobi launch of Amnesty International's global report, Muthoni Wanyeki, the group's regional director for East Africa, the Horn, and the Great Lakes, says there has been a backtracking in global human rights, giving examples from some of the 11 countries she monitors.
Obviously, none of us would deny that we're seeing growing or higher than usual intolerance of dissent, whether we're talking about the hardening of positions in Burundi, Eritrea, Ethiopia under the state of emergency, Kenya even in terms of sort of the informal attacks on human rights defenders, South Sudan, the mass detentions there, Sudan and Tanzania.
And, says Wanyeki, the fragility of some African states is especially worrisome, as some leaders try to hang on to power.
Not too long ago, we were celebrating the end of many conflicts within Africa. We're now at the 10-year period, the transition period, so the two constitutional terms of 5 years. And what are we seeing? No transition. We're seeing attempts to change things, etc. And is 10 years really enough to deal with all the grievances, all the feelings of exclusion, all the that brought that conflict about?
Steve Coburn, Amnesty International's Deputy Regional Director for West and Central Africa, says that in every country where his team researched, there were banned protests, demonstrators who had been arrested, and even 8 or 9 who were killed.
So I think we're seeing a growing crackdown on free protests. And I think the other kind of major trend that we have is on the spread of conflict across the region. So, civilians have been killed in countries around the Lake Chad region, with Boko Haram, around the Sahel, in Central African Republic, but also in areas that we didn't used to see.
With respect to South Africa, Wanyeki argues that the country should be leading the way in human rights, but has fallen short.
The political tensions, the xenophobia towards migrant workers, asylum seekers, is of great concern because basically it is losing its moral authority to provide leadership on the continent.
Activist Boniface Mwangi attended the Nairobi launch, paying special attention to the Kenyan report, which discussed the extrajudicial killings of a lawyer, his client, and their driver in June, and violations by security agencies during counterterrorism operations, among other issues.
But I think we need to go beyond reporting. That's my call. We need to do more than this. Amnesty is doing a fantastic job, but what can you do to ensure that people don't just die and they become statistic for next year's report?
Amnesty says there are some success stories from the continent. Chad's former president and the DRC's former vice president were convicted for war crimes and crimes against humanity. South Africa's Supreme Court criticized the government for allowing Sudan's president, who has a warrant out for his arrest, to leave the country after a 2015 visit. And Kenya's High Court struck down the government's decision to close the Dadaab refugee camp. Jill Craig, VOA News, Nairobi.
South Africa's High Court ruled today that the government cannot withdraw from the International Criminal Court without parliamentary approval, VOA's Anita Powell reports.
Constitutional activists briefly celebrated the legal victory Wednesday, and in the very next breath warned that the High Court ruling does not mean South Africa's fight over the International Criminal Court is over. An October notice of intent to withdraw from the War Crimes Court was made by South Africa's cabinet, but the High Court ruled only Parliament can make such a call. The cabinet is composed of stalwarts from the ruling African National Congress, so their decision to withdraw from the ICC did not allow the opposition to effectively argue. That October decision prompted the opposition Democratic Alliance to lead this case to court. Executive Director Kajal Ramjethan Keo is the executive director of the Southern Africa Litigation Center, which was involved in the case as a supporting respondent. The advocacy group has long argued that South Africa should remain in the court.
I do not think it means that South Africa will say that it will now remain with the International Criminal Court. And much the opposite would be true. South Africa is determined to leave the International Criminal Court. So I think that they are going to follow the necessary procedures that it takes in order for them to remove themselves procedurally and substantively in the correct way.
She says those who want to leave the court will have to start over and take their case to Parliament, where it is likely the ANC will fight to withdraw. South Africa announced its intent to leave the court in 2015, citing the government's decision to give Sudan's wanted president diplomatic immunity during an African Union summit. South African officials declined to move on his ICC arrest warrant. Center for Constitutional Rights Director Pelepilani Dube notes this ruling allows another critical group to contribute to the debate.
That now that the process is before Parliament, Parliament will be forced to open up the process to the public. So in that sense, then the public can then make their comments.
Both legal experts said the issue eventually will come down to politics. The ANC dominates Parliament, and it has come out strongly in favor of withdrawal. But the opposition will fight back hard, says Shadow Minister of International Relations and Cooperation, Stevens Mokolapa of the Democratic Alliance.
We will definitely be taking this judgment as a basis for non-withdrawal from the ICC, and we will continue to challenge through parliamentary process any effort to withdraw the ICC.
Gambia recently reversed its decision to leave the court, but Dube says she does not think that will convince other African nations to stay, especially after an AU decision last month that it would support any member's bid to leave the court.
One wants to be positive about it, but I think at the same time, for a very long time, a lot of African states, and including the African Union, have been of the view that the ICC is unfairly targeting African countries.
She says the ruling gives South Africa, and possibly other nations, pause to think about whether they really want to go through this lengthy and complicated process. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
The International Organization for Migration says it's deeply concerned about the ongoing anti-immigrant violence in South Africa, and it says it's also worried about an anti-immigrant march planned for Friday. The violence began over the weekend in various locations and continued through yesterday. Some houses, shops, and businesses owned by foreign nationals were looted and burned. The International Organization for Migration says there may be as many as 5 million migrants in South Africa, or about 10% of the population. Richard Otts is the IOM Chief of Mission in South Africa. From Pretoria, he spoke with VOA's Joe DiCapua.
What we're seeing is an increased incidence of violence specifically directed against migrants, mostly in the outskirts of Pretoria, but it is not unlikely that this will continue to spread to the rest of the country. And we're saying that based on experience, particularly from 2008 and 2015, where there were widespread incidences of violence directed against migrants. Dozens of people were killed. Additionally, hundreds of shops were looted, and literally thousands of people were temporarily displaced from their current place of residence. So obviously it's something that has affected the migrant community significantly. It is also something that the South African government has been very concerned about for humanitarian reasons, but also because of the public image of the country.
Are any particular foreigners being targeted?
Many of the foreigners in South Africa are from the SADC region, so Zimbabwe, Mozambique, Malawi. But we also see that particularly Nigerians this time are being singled out as targets or potential targets for the xenophobic violence. But this is not unique to this particular case. Nigerians, unfortunately, do not enjoy a very good reputation in the country. Negative sentiments towards migrants often do focus on Nigerians in particular.
Why do you think you're seeing a spate of violence now? Was there any particular incident that may have triggered it?
Well, what people typically allude to as a cause for the current violence is a recent statement by the mayor of Johannesburg, where he explicitly associated migrants and crime and urged migrants, particularly illegal migrants, to go home. That is something that, of course, is of great concern to us and of the Department of Home Affairs, who has the main mandate on managing migration in the country. And we're very pleased that the Minister of Home Affairs very publicly distanced himself from that statement and urged the mayor to reconsider those kind of statements. And we have seen also in 2015, there was a statement by the Zulu King in KwaZulu-Natal, one of the provinces, also with very negative sentiments towards migrants. And then that was also blamed for the outbreak of violence against migrants.
Now, the International Organization for Migration says it's also very concerned about the planned march against migrants that is scheduled for Friday. Tell us about that.
There's been a call for a march or demonstration against migrants for a while. It is obviously of great concern to us, mostly because in the past we have seen that those kind of demonstrations obviously result in violence against migrants. So it is not a peaceful demonstration typically. It is something that ultimately in the past has resulted in looting, in burning, in physical attacks against migrants. And we are concerned that the demonstration of Friday could also lead to similar excesses.
Now, the IOM says there are three main root causes of violence against migrants. What are the causes, in your view?
The first one is indeed feelings of xenophobia, people who really do not like migrants. The second one is opportunism, people who take advantage of the breakdown of rule of law to enrich themselves with impunity. And they take advantage of the fact that law enforcement agencies and officers are not able to contain the violence, to break into shops, to steal stuff and not face the legal consequences for that. And then the third one is probably the most important one, scapegoatism. Particularly in the townships, in informal settlements, a lot of residents have problems with the service delivered by the government in terms of employment creation, access to health care, good quality education, and security. The residents often blame this on the presence of migrants. So we feel that the response of the government to these three root causes should be guided by exactly these three elements. So the first one requires social cohesion programming. The second one is a strictly law enforcement issue. And the third one requires improvements in service delivery, particularly in the townships and the informal settlements, in order to reduce some of the friction between the migrants and the host communities.
Richard Otts is the IOM Chief of Mission in South Africa. From Pretoria, he spoke with VOA's Joe DiCapua. Organizers of Friday's anti-immigrant march say the march will be peaceful and that they are not xenophobic.
Eighteen past the hour, you're listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. Inauguration ceremonies were held today for Somalia's new president. Mohamed Abdullahi Mohamed was elected earlier this month. AP Coates, the new Somali leader, is saying it may take another 20 years to fix the country's problems. He says the main obstacles are insecurity and humanitarian crisis. He's also promised to tackle corruption. Al-Shabaab militants continue to plague the country, including bomb attacks in the capital, Mogadishu.
Zimbabwe President Robert Mugabe may be considering adopting the South African rand as his country's currency. The Johannesburg Business Report says Mugabe hinted at that yesterday in a televised interview on his 93rd birthday. He said he has asked his finance minister and central bank governor to explore that possibility. Zimbabwe has a faltering economy and is in the midst of a cash crisis. He recently issued new bond notes to try to deal with the problem.
While military force and ideological campaigns are being used against such groups as Islamic State, Boko Haram, and other extremist groups, there is a call to open a new and different offensive against them. The watchdog organization Transparency International has released a new report indicating that corruption is a root cause of terror groups. Catherine Dixon is director of Transparency International from London. She spoke to VOA's Mohamed El-Shenawi.
We looked at corruption as the driving force of violent extremism and found that it was enabling this in three ways. The first is that violent extremism and groups like Islamic State use corruption as a recruitment tool. So they draw on the deep public anger at the abuse of official power to get people to join them. They also use corruption as a facilitator. So they use it to smuggle arms across borders, or they might use smuggled drugs to pay their operatives. And then finally, corruption has, in many cases, eviscerated the institutions which you'd hope would check the progress of groups like so-called Islamic State. So when Mosul fell, you know, the people that were supposed to be there, the troops that were supposed to be there to defend it, just simply weren't there.
How was corruption in Nigeria a weapon that Nigerian militant group Boko Haram used to garner support?
Boko Haram's been around for a while, and I think it intersects in these different ways. So you've got security forces or police forces that are shaking people down on the streets, extorting money from them. And this feeling of injustice that people have about those forces that are supposed to protect them are actually the biggest creator of insecurity, human insecurity to them. And it makes people extremely angry. So when groups like Boko Haram set themselves up as the solution to it, as the answer to corruption, it becomes an attractive force for people. But at the same time, we've seen corruption within the Nigerian military itself, also meaning that they're not really capable of responding to those groups, whether it's, you know, units in the Nigerian military that haven't got the money they're supposed to have because someone higher up the chain has stolen it, or because they haven't got the right equipment because procurement budgets are being stolen. So I think corruption really affects this in quite a number of different ways.
So what's wrong with the continuous efforts tackling the ideology of groups like ISIS, focusing only on the religious rhetoric they produce?
Yeah, this is the instinct, I think, sometimes in liberal democracies. It's to frame these sort of threats that we see from violent extremism in terms of a global confrontation of values. So you've got the force of radical Islam on the one hand, pitched against, you know, this liberal world order on the other. But I think these foreign policy narratives that look at ideology overlook, you know, the exploitative governing structures and the state predation that has enabled groups to thrive, the underlying corruption that is driving people towards these groups. And it's only once they join them that they may become radicalized.
Transparency International issued another report on drastic decline for anti-corruption efforts in the Middle East and North Africa. How would you describe that decline?
What we found in the Middle East is that, you know, although a lot of money is put into security, a lot of defense spending is made, and a lot of support from, you know, allies in the West is given to a lot of countries in the Middle East, actually these forces are quite fragile because the institutional controls and the accountability and transparency that's necessary to make for strong defense forces just isn't there. So I think there's a lot more that countries in, you know, in this region could do to look at, you know, the institutions that they're building and making sure that they're robust and going to be effective for the long term.
Catherine Dixon is director of Transparency International. She spoke to VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawi.
President Trump and the U.S. media have had a tense relationship. The president often denigrates the mainstream press, accusing them of reporting fake news. At the same time, the media have accused Trump and members of his administration of not always telling the truth. So what's at stake for journalists in the current climate, and does it affect how journalism should be taught? Professor Betsy West is a documentary and online filmmaker with over 30 years network television experience. West teaches at the Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism in New York. She spoke with VOA's Adam Phillips about President Trump and the media.
I do think that it's one of the most enervating and exciting times in journalism in many ways, because the president has attacked the media and has been at war with the media. It's a not unfamiliar tactic to go after the press when you don't like the information that they're reporting. And yet I see that there are so many reporters who are rising to the challenge in a very measured way, and trying very hard not to get distracted by the attacks.
How do you stay focused when everything that he says is often a bombshell?
The answer to that is to just keep your eye on the ball and make sure that everything you are reporting is absolutely true. This election was a wake-up call for the media because it turns out that we are in our various silos, and there's a large part of America that is not reading what we consider to be the mainstream media and doesn't believe it, and does believe that it's fake news, does believe that it's the lying press. And that's a serious concern for journalists and something that we have to study and understand and really confront.
But is there any blame that the mainstream media has in coming to this pass?
I think there's blame to go around. There was some fantastic reporting going on, but the mainstream media perhaps was not listening to the voices of the people in the heartland who were saying, hey, wait a minute, the Democrats aren't helping us. They haven't helped us. We have problems here. And in a way, I think a lot of their voices weren't heard as much. I take that criticism, and I think many other journalists do as well. We have to go out into the country, into the world, and talk to people, and listen to people, and understand what their problems are, and what their issues are, and not be so smart alecky.
You teach graduate-level aspiring journalists. Is there any reorientation that you felt necessary to put in place in terms of what you tell them journalism is or what this new environment might mean for them going forward after they graduate?
Well, I think a lot of our students were stunned after the election. They were like, what happened? And in terms of what I teach, I think what's happened reinforces the fundamentals. I do have students who feel very passionate about issues and in some ways can border on activism. And what I try to do is teach them how to look at all the facts, how to surround a story, how to confirm a story. I think you have to go into stories with a skeptical point of view, no matter what the story is. I think that is more important than ever. And I also think confirming facts, because if you make a mistake, it undermines your credibility and it makes you vulnerable to people who say you have an agenda. We're all humans, people make mistakes, and when you do make a reporting mistake, then you need to correct it immediately.
So you're fairly optimistic, it sounds like, even though you're a little worried.
There are many interesting avenues to explore. Look, every day there are major new developments. Hard to keep on top of every single thing. But if you look at the subscriptions for newspapers, they're up. If you look at viewership for news channels, they're up. I see my students are energized. They want to go out there. They want to report on the immigration story. They want to find underreported stories. So you can't help be infected by their optimism, and they're looking forward. So I guess we might as well look forward too.
Professor Betsy West teaches reporting, documentary, and video storytelling at the Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism in New York. She spoke with VOA's Adam Phillips.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC.
For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of Africa News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Nick Ivanoff, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, U.S. President Donald Trump has made his first phone calls to African heads of state, speaking with Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari and South African President Jacob Zuma. An in-depth discussion on the expectations of the president's engagement with Africa. That's right here on the next Straight Talk Africa at 1830 UTC.
VOAAfrica.com.
On VOAAfrica.com, the news updates never stop. Our primary goal is to keep you informed.
VOAAfrica.com, your trusted source for news and information.